CMC Markets is one of the world's leading CFD and spread betting providers with more than three decades of experience. Trade with CMC and you're trading with experts. 79% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Hello and welcome to the City View, the podcast from City AM in partnership with CMC Markets. Join me, Christian May, each week as I talk to insiders, industry chiefs and leading figures from business, finance, politics and the media.
Hello and welcome to the City View podcast. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM. Today we are joined by Michael Hewson, Chief Markets Analyst at CMC Markets, and a man who is in demand across the city and further afield indeed for clear-eyed, clear-headed analysis of the markets at home as well as internationally. We'll touch on Brexit, on the aftermath of the US election, and no doubt much more. But first, Michael, good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks very much, Andy. It's good to be talking to City AM again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as the city sort of starts to look back on this strange year of 2020 and with news of a vaccine, heightening optimism perhaps for a more normal 2021, or at least the back half of it, plenty to chew over. But perhaps the best way to jump in is something that has been dominating the news headlines away from COVID for the last few days and will no doubt dominate them for a few days yet to come. And that's the thorny topic of Brexit. Now, as we're speaking, which is about 6 or 7 hours before this podcast will become available, there are some noises off from Brussels that there may have been finally a breakthrough on a trade deal between the UK and the European Union after negotiations that I think are best described as somewhere between fraught and theatrical. What's your feeling on whether they will finally find this landing zone?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably categorize them as tortuous. It's been actually a tortuous last 4.5 years, if I'm honest. But I am encouraged by the fact that some of the briefings out of Ireland have been much more positive. Simon Coveney, only earlier this month, said that the deal was 90% done. And I think when you look at it through that prism, I think for the deal to founder on the last 5 or 10% would be bordering on criminal. So I think from that perspective, and if I'd look at it through that perspective and try and strip away all of the briefings, the counter briefings and everything else, the fact that Ursula von der Leyen has said that the pathway to a deal is there, albeit it's a narrow one, it suggests that we are going to have a deal. And ultimately, I think we'll probably get a deal anyway, because I think the downside to not getting one would be, I think, a failure of statecraft, not only on the UK side, but also on the EU side. And I think it would sort of justify some of the criticism that's been levelled at the EU, that trying to negotiate with the EU as a caucus of 27 different countries is a very, very difficult thing to do. And I don't think there's any argument about that. It has been a very, very difficult process, given the fact that the UK and the European Union are already coming at this from a position of regulatory convergence. And really, it's about the level of divergence as we go forward through our separate ways. And I think that's obviously what's been at the core of this. I think there has been some progress on the level playing field. Let's hope so, which brings us down to the thorny issue of fishing. And ultimately, I think that there will be a solution there. Yes, Emmanuel Macron has been playing hardball, but ultimately, for the French, if there is no deal by the 31st of December, they lose complete access to UK fishing grounds. So it's still within their interests to arrive at a deal on fishing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't think any of us would have thought as we woke up on the 24th of June 2016, I say woke up on the 24th of June 2016, many of us...
I never went to sleep.
Yeah, moving from the whiskey to the coffee perhaps in the morning, would have thought that we would be sat here 15 days to go till departure, still arguing about fishing of all things. I suppose we'll come onto the impact on markets and how a Brexit deal, if we do indeed get there, would affect the outlook for 2021 first. But more broadly, taking a step back, and as you say, getting rid of the counter briefings and so on and so forth, have you been surprised that particularly over the past, let's say, 6 to 12 months, that the needs of the city and financial services firms to have a degree of clarity and certainty about the future seems to have taken such a back seat, considering its hugely outsized impact on the UK's economic performance and how important it will be to the recovery from the COVID-19 hit. Have you been surprised by how maybe the noises off from government just haven't been around financial services? It's sort of been a focus on other sectors of the economy, which, you know, realistically are not, you know, in the same world.
I think, Andy, there's a political element to this. And ultimately, while financial services is a very big proportion of the UK economy, I think in terms of political capital, there's not an awful lot of sympathy, public sympathy for financial services. I still think that the scars from the financial crisis are still very apparent. And ultimately, I think financial services are big enough and ugly enough, I think, to look after themselves. I think the sheer size of the financial services sector will mean that any attempts by the EU to try and undermine it will prove to be very, very difficult. And you've certainly seen that borne out by the fact that all of the horror stories that were basically trotted out by both sides in the lead up to the Brexit referendum haven't come to pass. You know, these headlines about, you know, sort of hundreds of thousands of jobs that were basically decamped to Frankfurt, to Paris and Amsterdam just really hasn't happened. And I think that is a cornerstone, I think, of why financial services probably hasn't been the priority that maybe it should have been. I think when you work in financial services, as I do, so much of it is done on a computerized basis. So much of it happens cross-border anyway. And the two biggest financial centers in the world are New York and London. And they tend to, you know, swap roles in terms of who's number one and have done for the past 20 or 30 years. That isn't going to change. The expertise is already here. There's a significant reluctance, I think, on a part of most people to move abroad. So really, it's just a question of how do financial services cope with the slightly different jurisdictions that will start to take shape over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. Yes, there will be a certain migration of jobs abroad as a result of the split between the UK and the EU. But ultimately, I think London is unique, not only in its terms of its geographical position, but I think also in terms of its expertise. And I think it's very unlikely that that will change anytime soon.
Yeah, nice to hear some optimism, which sometimes this year has been in short supply, but I'm pretty much inclined to agree. And of course, the other thing, the great unknowable is always or any jobs that may leave, any assets that do leave, they will be replaced in new innovative ways. We just don't know what they are yet, otherwise we'd be doing them. Just looking ahead to sort of 2021, and let's take the working assumption that a deal will be struck of some kind. Where does that play out for you in the outlook for 2021, particularly for sterling?
I'm actually fairly constructive on sterling. I have been for the past couple of years. And yes, we did see a bit of a dip against the dollar to 1.15. But that wasn't Brexit related. That was as a direct result of the pandemic, when that started to basically breeze a trail of destruction across the global economy in March and April, and we had all of those lockdowns, and you saw a flight to safety in the context of the US dollar. In terms of where I think the pound is likely to go over the course of the next 12 months, I think there's a more than even chance we'll see a move up to 140 and 145, more than we'll see a move back to 120 and 125. I think when you actually look at what's been hanging over sterling, and assuming that the Bank of England doesn't cut rates into negative territory, I still think that is a very controversial course of action to take, and I think it's unlikely the Bank of England will embark on that route. I think it's likely to be dictated to less, I think, by Brexit risks and more by a deterioration in the economic outlook more globally as a result of coronavirus. So I'm assuming a continuation, a successful rollout of the vaccine, continued constructive dialogue between us and the European Union, because the talks won't stop after the 1st of January. We will still be continuing to discuss the future relationship for probably the next 5 or 10 years. After all, on a geographical basis, they are on our doorstep. They face enormous challenges of their own, notwithstanding the economic recovery in countries like Spain, Italy, and France. And for me, I think the pound will benefit to a certain extent from a weaker euro as well, because I think the European Central Bank is already uncomfortable with the value of the euro as it is right now. And that would suggest that we could well see a stronger pound pretty much against a host of currencies as the government puts its missteps, its first year missteps or its growing pains behind it, you'd like to think, and then really starts to focus on what it should have been doing a year ago on its domestic agenda. So for me, I'm constructive on the pound, move back to 140 initially in the first quarter and maybe a push up to 145. But in the here and now, I would hope to see a move to 140 against the dollar in the first quarter of next year.
Mm, interesting. It's amazing how much the arrival of the vaccine, obviously the UK, the first to begin rolling any vaccine out, and with the prospect of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, an awful lot cheaper, as we all now know, to roll out across the country, that can start hitting those people who are medium and perhaps even in time low risk. This has completely changed the level of optimism for 2021. But obviously, you know, the economic damage caused this year, I was thinking just about the UK for now, has been extremely significant. We still await kind of a real clarity on where inflation might go next year, as a sort of fiscal stimulus. The amount of fiscal stimulus that went into the economy continues to play itself out and have its impact. Constructive on the pound then suggests that you're perhaps more optimistic than some of the analysts who are thinking the UK economy is moving towards a sort of permanent scarring.
Well, if it is, then we're going to be in the same leaky boat, because if you look at the economic scarring of France and Italy and what have you, currencies and economies aren't zero-sum games. And I think it's important to remember that when you look at not only the UK economy, but you look at the people and the countries that it trades with. I think the European Union is going to have to do an awful lot more to help its weaker members if it's to hold together. One of the key concerns I've had for quite some time now is the lack of fiscal coherence that the EU has had with respect to helping its weaker members. They've only just now agreed the 750 billion euro recovery plan that they agreed in the middle of the summer. And that's going to be a key, you know, that's going to be a key factor for the EU as we head into 2021. And that's assuming that all these restrictions come off in January and February of next year. So I think when you look at it through that sort of prism and you talk about economic scarring, I think it depends on the fiscal response. And one thing that I think has been a positive, albeit maybe not enough, has been the fiscal response of the UK Treasury and the UK government. Certainly when you compare it to, say, for example, like the US, where there's bipartisan infighting, and in the European Union, where you've got the hawkish North, and you've obviously got the more fiscally liberal South. So I think for me, it really depends on the fiscal response. And certainly there is room to do an awful lot more when you actually look at where gilt yields are at this moment in time.
Mm. Fiscally liberal is a glorious euphemism for some of those Southern European economies, which I greatly enjoy.
I was trying to be polite.
I've listened to some German analysts being less polite in recent years. Crossing the pond, so you obviously spoke to my my predecessor, Christian May, back in October, looking ahead to the US election, and it certainly proved right on your prediction then that Joe Biden would certainly win the presidency. And you also pretty much called right that he would likely face a Senate that will not give him the opportunity to run through some of his more eye-catching, we'll say, we'll stick to the euphemisms, economic policies that turned up on the trail. You also suggested that it may not be the most clear-cut election in terms of when we knew who might win. So 3 out of 3 on that front. Markets at the moment sort of buoyed by hopes of a, you know, coming stimulus package. You alluded there to the partisan infighting. When you look at the US economy, and again, looking ahead to 2021, and you have to almost separate it from, so it almost 2021 starts over there almost on the 20th of January rather than on the 1st, assuming that the current incumbent does actually leave on the 19th.
Oh, I think he will.
You'd hope so. He seems to have become resigned to the basic normal, the basic sort of democratic norms. When you look at fiscal stimulus, how are you looking at that? Are you looking at it as a game changer, or is it something that remains just a little too uncertain to make any calls right now?
I think at this moment in time, I think the immediate concern is the expiry of the CARES Act unemployment benefits at the end of this month. 12 million Americans will lose their unemployment benefits unless there is a new stimulus plan or an economic aid package agreed by those on Capitol Hill by the end of this week, maybe early next week. So for the here and now, what we need to see is, however big the stimulus package is, whether it's $900 billion, whether it's $1 trillion, whether it's $745 billion, whatever that package is, what we need to see in the here and now, before the 20th of January, is an agreement on that at least. Because I think what the last few weeks have taught us is that in the aftermath of the expiry of the last stimulus plan in July, the US economy is actually borne up fairly well. But we are now starting to see evidence of a slowdown, a big jump in weekly jobless claims, some very weak retail sales numbers for November, and a downward revision in October. And the fear is, in the face of rising coronavirus cases, over 300,000 US dead, that you will see a significant downturn in the first quarter of next year. And that should terrify both parties, because ultimately it will be a plague on all your houses unless you agree some form of deal. So I think for the here and now, that's what we want to see in the short term. Certainly US markets are reflecting a deal in that regard. And then it's really a question of whether or not those two seats that are up for grabs in Georgia on the Senate either stay where they are or fall to the Democrats. Now, if they fall to the Democrats, the picture becomes slightly more positive in terms of fiscal stimulus. If they don't, and the status quo is maintained, then ultimately we could get the next 2 years until the midterms of what I would call back and forth, shall we say, with respect to Biden having to pair his expectations for the first 2 years of his presidency, assuming, of course, that he lasts that long and Kamala Harris doesn't take over in the meantime. I say that sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek, but only slightly.
You never know. I mean, you're a markets analyst, and sort of your expertise is obviously looking forward as much as anything, and we all want your predictions and whatever for years to come. But something you alluded to there about the potential for, you know, a downturn in 2021. When we sit back and assess the economic legacy of President Trump's 4 years, parking, you know, the excitement / furore over his tweets, his rather extraordinary approach to foreign policy, parking all that aside, you know, obviously, if you look at the S&P 500 over 4 years, it's, you know, it's all happy days. But is that, that's a simplistic reading, or is it?
Yes and no. It really depends on who you talk to. I mean, I don't think it's any surprise or any secret that President Trump was a very divisive US president. But ultimately, when he came to power, he made a number of key pledges. And by and large, he's pretty much delivered on a lot of them. He pledged to raise the pay of some of the lowest paid US workers. And he did that. He delivered on that. And I don't think that's widely recognized. And it's not for nothing that he's probably garnered the most votes of any losing US president in terms of, you know, being beaten by Joe Biden. So, whatever your opinions on him, and to be quite honest, he's done what he said he would do. His style and his delivery is obviously very unique, and he's brushed an awful lot of people up, or rubbed an awful lot of people up the wrong way. But at the end of the day, he's still proven to be a very popular US president, even if you don't like the way he conducts himself. Otherwise, how do you explain he got as many votes as he did? The fact of the matter was that he was up against a Democrat machine, as well, which was very well oiled, but also he completely misjudged the coronavirus pandemic. And I think that, more than anything, cost him the presidency, because if you look at his polling numbers up until including February and March, he was favourite to win. And that says more about the Democrats than it does about him.
It does, and fair to say, facing a candidate, he didn't necessarily light many fires across the campaign trail. It's it'll be a fascinating. I mean, there will be. I had a wonderful joke the other day.
There's a saying, Andy: never interrupt your opponent when he's making a mistake. And Trump made loads in March and April. So Biden's best tactic was just to keep shtum and just let Trump run his mouth off, and that cost him.
Yeah, I saw a great line the other day that. PhDs used to be written about history over the course of 2 or 3 years, and now they're written over the history of 2 or 3 tweets. And maybe that'll be our takeaway from the Trump presidency. But I'm just thinking, you know, with your sort of analyst hat on, you know, obviously the last CityM Awards that we had in 2019 quite happened in 2020 for a number of reasons you can probably guess at. You're up for Analyst of the Year for your calls on things like Uber and Lyft. Thinking about those, or I say they're tech firms in some ways, they weren't. That was their down, almost their downfall.
That was their downfall.
Yeah. When you look at towards next year and some of those kind of the companies similar to that that have had tough couple of years now coming out of a pandemic, what's your sort of sense of some of those companies and their recovery from those terrible years?
Well, I really suppose it really depends on. What sort of firms you're talking about. I mean, I make no apologies for my calls on Uber and Lyft. I thought they were overvalued then, and I still think they're overvalued. And I think, if anything, certain parts of the US market have become even more frothy. You've only got to look at Airbnb to get an indication as to the fact that the US markets or US investors have lost their minds. You know, you've got a company like Airbnb that's valued at more than the likes of Marriott and Hilton Worldwide collectively. You know, I mean, how is that a reasonable valuation? It just simply is not. So I think what you will see next year is some of the more frothy valuations in the US market start to come down. Why? Because what will happen is that you'll probably see a much broader recovery in indexes like the FTSE 100, for example, which is still 13% down from where it started the year. And that could start to play catch up because valuations on the FTSE and the FTSE 250 are certainly in the area of being cheap. Now, obviously, that doesn't necessarily mean they can't get cheaper, but certainly in terms of overall downside, there's much lower risk in investing in, say, for example, a FTSE 100 tracker than there is in, say, for example, a NASDAQ or an S&P 500 tracker. So in terms of the IPOs that we've seen this year, there's any number of them I wouldn't touch with a barge pole, simply on the basis of the fact that their valuations aren't based in anything like reality. But unfortunately, you could describe an awful lot of companies in the US stock market in those terms. So for me, I'm very cautious about US stocks on a specific basis in terms of, say, for example, the smaller tech firms, if you could call them tech firms, tech services, I suppose. Airbnb is a tech services firm. DoorDash, another example. In terms of markets I'd probably be more comfortable in, I've already mentioned the UK market. I think there's a good chance we could go back to 7,000 in the first quarter of next year, assuming all being well, and potentially even a revisit of the peaks that we saw at the beginning of this year. So there's certainly potential for the FTSE 100 to play catch up. Beyond that, I think it's very, very difficult because I think for the past 2 years, you've sort of had to suspend your more analytical head and just go with the trend that's currently in place. And the trend that's currently in place for all stock markets has been buy the dip.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, a broad-based recovery across the FTSE 100 is a fine place to finish our podcasting for 2020 as we look ahead to 2021. This will be the last podcast before the new year. We'll still be beavering away on cityam.com, of course. Michael, plans for Christmas?
I do, but it really depends on whether or not I'm allowed to go to Scotland for more than 2 days.
Well, yeah, as we record this,
because I have family up there who I haven't seen for about 6 months, and I haven't seen my mother for about the same amount of time. So I'm hoping to see my mother and then see my partner's sister and mother as well.
Yeah, we all, fingers crossed, might get some clarity on such matters sooner rather than later. There's only a week to go. It's not as if they knew when Christmas was coming. Michael, let's leave it there. Thanks so much, Chief Markets Analyst at CMC Markets. And thanks to CMC Markets for supporting this podcast throughout the second half of 2020. And for now, from all of us at City AM, thanks so much for keeping the faith with us all year, for reading cityam.com as we shifted from print to digital. It'll be digital for a little while yet on the other side as we wait for the vaccine to roll out, but hopefully we'll be back on your screens and in your hand sooner rather than later in 2021. Merry Christmas from us all.
Thanks for listening to The City View, the podcast from City AM in partnership with CMC Markets. Do join me again next week.
CMC Markets is one of the world's leading CFD and spread betting providers with more than 3 decades of experience. Trade with CMC and you're trading with experts. 79% of retail investor accounts lose money.